It's an architecture of containment. There is no other structure like it. It's a prison. It's a construction that tells us that people were held here against their will.
Remembering Alaska's role in locking up Japanese Americans during World War II. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, February 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, what is going on with Alaska's winter?
When you are getting this much melting after this much snowpack, it is a situation that tends to set up quite a bit of flooding.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
New historical evidence is shedding light on the internment of Japanese people in Alaska during World War II. A small ceremony held Friday at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson was the first of its kind, according to speakers at the event. As KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, the ceremony fell on the official Day of Remembrance and is part of an effort recognizing the experiences of the Japanese community in Southeast Alaska during the war years.
Alice Tanaka Hokito was 9 years old on the night in 1941 when FBI agents took her father from their home in Juneau.
He turned to us and quietly said, "I may not be home for a while." And the next moment, he was gone into the December darkness, taken by the men who had put confusion and fear in our hearts. Little did we know at that time that he would not be home for a very long while.
Her father was one of 17 men brought to the Army's Fort Richardson base in Anchorage for several months before they were sent to an internment camp in New Mexico. Hokito and the rest of the family stayed in Juneau until April of 1942. Then they were deported to a camp in Idaho. The family was part of 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry on the Pacific coast detained for years during World War II.
And about 200 came from Alaska.
Hokito spoke to a room of a few dozen people as part of the Day of Remembrance held every year on February 19th, the anniversary of an executive order that forcibly removed Japanese Americans from their communities to government camps. Colonel Timothy Wolfe is the Deputy Installation Commander for Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, and he says this is the first such event of its kind held at the base.
Something like this should never happen again. Should not happen again.
The event's uniqueness comes partly from the fact that it's taking place inside a building sitting on the actual site of the little-known internment camp that was only recently evidenced.
Well, we're looking out of the Army Reserve building here on J-Bear, looking roughly south out into the parking lot.
Dr. Morgan Blanchard is an archaeologist and uncovered a rare map showing where the camp was built.
Just 5 feet from where we're standing is where the north fence of this camp was, and there were two strands of barbed wire fence that ran through there. The area was cleared so that it could be lit with electric lights, and there were guard towers on each of the corners. We have no photos of the guard towers, but we assumed that they were armed.
How come that layout and that structure is so important to you, or so interesting to note?
Well, it's important because it's an architecture of containment. There is no other structure like it. It's a prison. It's a construction that tells us that people were held here against their will.
Blanchard says while Japanese men were brought to Fort Richardson in December of 1941, it wasn't until February that construction of the actual camp started. And even then, it wasn't much. 16 by 16 Arctic tents on top of wooden platforms with latrines and walkways. By the time it was done, in June of 1942, the 17 men had been moved. The camp has long been known about, but physical evidence offering clues about the particulars have been sparse. The ceremony was held the same day as a screening of the documentary The Empty Chair, which tells the story of this captivity from the perspective of the Japanese community in Southeast Alaska. Before Hokito and her family were deported from Juneau, the high school arranged an early graduation for her brother John.
Later the next month in May, when the actual graduation took place, an empty chair was placed with the rest of the graduating students to honor John and to acknowledge his absence and the absence of the total Japanese community from Juneau.
Akito says that in the last 20 years, more people have begun sharing stories about their experiences in the internment camps, which she sees as deeply relevant to the present.
When people get fearful, you know, we tend to lose our sense of what's right and wrong, and we need to really always be strong enough to stand up for any type of injustice.
The ceremony was organized by the Alaska chapter of the Japanese American Citizens League, which is asking the Army to let them use the area as an interpretive site, permanently commemorating all that happened. From Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
A nearly 60-year-old record for no snowfall in Anchorage went down over the weekend. National Weather Service meteorologist Dave Snyder confirmed that Saturday night was the 37th day in a row without snow for Anchorage. The previous record was set in 1958 when no snow fell from January 21st to February 25th. The record was matched on Friday at midnight and beaten the following evening. Areas of the southern Kenai Peninsula reported between 12 to 30 inches of snowfall over the weekend, in addition to heavy rain showers. Rebecca Duell, a forecaster with the National Weather Service in Anchorage, says the amount of snowfall will most likely decrease over the next few days.
The temperatures will be warming. They'll probably be hovering in the upper 30s to low 40s for most of the southern Kenai Peninsula. It should mainly be rain showers that we're going to be seeing, but there could be some snow showers mixed in, especially during the night.
Rain and rising temperatures are predicted to melt the snow and create slippery conditions, and there's an added danger of flooding.
We will be monitoring the rivers, and right now we don't have any reports of flooding, but when you are getting this much melting after this much snowpack, it is a situation that tends to set up quite a bit of flooding.
This winter's warmer than normal weather could set an Alaska record. National Weather Service Alaska Region Climate Science and Services Manager Rick Toman points to a lack of extreme cold temperatures across the state.
When we look at the whole state, looking at all of the FAA airport stations, the weather service stations, the lowest temperature reported so far has been 47 below at Arctic Village. And in the past century, Alaska has not had a winter when someplace didn't report a temperature of at least 53 below. And almost all winters, somebody gets it to at least 55 below.
Fairbanks' lowest temperature so far this winter is 29 below. A December 2015 reading, Toman says, just barely eclipses the low mark of another unusually warm Fairbanks winter.
In 1976-77, the lowest temperature at the Fairbanks Airport was 28 below. We've already been 1 degree lower than that, so we won't have the warmest winter minimum, but this would be, if it holds up, the second winter in 110 years when it didn't get to 30 below.
Tolman notes that the 1976-77 winter was characterized by a shift in the Pacific decadal oscillation toward warmer ocean temperatures. He says the recent year's unusual Northeast Pacific warmth, known as the blob, has transitioned to a similar condition.
The blob has grown up into a PDO, and we're left with still a blob-like looking feature in the Northeast Pacific. That warm water that had characterized the blob is now extending to a significant depth. And so that will take a long time for that to be mixed out and to cool back to normal.
Toman says a strong El Nino, which more prominently drove this winter's weather, is waning, but also expected to continue to help keep temperatures above normal across Alaska through the remainder of the winter. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the permanent fund and the budget shortfall.
Every expenditure means there's less money for my dividend. And if that happens, you may have the public looking over your shoulder.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Regional Hospital. With hospital-wide renovations and upgrades, it's a brand new day at Alaska Regional Hospital. And by Full Circle, delivering organic produce and groceries across Alaska since 2006, featuring fresh pasta, coffee, fish, and baked items from Alaskan producers. More at fullcircle.com/APRN.
There are currently three proposals aimed at helping to close the state's budget shortfall using the permanent fund. Legislators are weighing which, if any, to support. Today, they heard from their own nonpartisan budget expert on what makes each plan unique. David Teal, the director of the Legislative Finance Division, notes these proposals would all change the source of Alaskans' annual dividends.
Essentially, the money appears to just fall out of the sky. The truth is that the dividend is a government check just like any other government check, and that it's very protected now.
Representative Mike Hawker's bill would essentially put dividends on hold, potentially for multiple years, until the state eliminated its deficit. Governor Bill Walker's plan would put $3.3 billion annually into the budget, providing a less volatile source of revenue than oil production taxes. But Teal noted that there is a risk that fund earnings in the future won't grow quickly enough to replenish that money. Teal contrasted that with Senator Liesl McGuire's bill, which would pay out 5% per year based on an average of the previous 5 years' earnings. Both Walker and McGuire have proposed using oil and gas royalties to pay dividends rather than the permanent fund. All three plans would likely reduce the amount available for dividends. Representative Mark Newman said he'd like to see voters have a direct say on how much the government spends. Teal responded that cutting dividend checks may catch the public's attention.
Every expenditure means there's less money for my dividend. And if that happens, you may have the public looking over your shoulder a little more than they do now as you prepare the budget. So I guess fair warning, be careful what you ask for.
It's not yet clear when the House will vote on legislation that would affect the permanent fund. President Obama told the nation's governors today that oil and coal-producing states should prepare for a shift to cleaner energy.
I want to be honest with you. If those states with extractive industries are not currently preparing for the fact that the energy mix is going to continue to change over time, you're probably doing a disservice to your constituencies.
Obama hosted the National Governors Association at the White House today. At the meeting, Alaska Governor Bill Walker pleaded for more access to drill on federal land, pointing to the state's massive budget deficit.
We got problems. We have an oil pipeline that's empty. I need to fill it up. There's a lot of oil up there, and we're going to get it safely, and thank you for some of your positions you've taken, but we need to put oil in that pipeline.
Obama told him it's a matter of balancing values.
You know, we have encouraged exploration in some areas. There's some areas that are just real sensitive.
Obama took the opportunity to again extol at length the beauty he saw when he visited Alaska last summer.
It fills up your soul being up there. Just the landscape and the expanse, the sheer scale of everything is remarkable. And the people could not have been more gracious wonderful.
Obama has proposed a new oil tax of $10.25 per barrel to fund low-polluting transportation systems. Republican leaders, though, say Congress will never approve it. After 5 years of work, a new middle school is opening in East Anchorage this fall, if the school can attract enough students. The STREAM Academy is focused on getting kids out of the classroom and doing hands-on research projects. The founders gave prospective students and their parents a taste of their teaching methods over the weekend. KSKA's Ann Hillman checked it out.
A group of soon-to-be sixth graders stand by a partially frozen stream by Begich Middle School with 4-H environmental educator and sometimes singer Kay Shoemaker.
I got no bones in my back. Try that.
I got no bones in my back.
Don't you understand me?
Don't you understand me?
I'm an invertebrate.
I'm an invertebrate.
You can squishy squash me.
They're getting a taste of a typical lesson at the STREAM Academy, a STEM-focused charter school that's slated to open this fall, though they aren't actually squashing any bugs, just catching them. Student Josephine Stone grabs a metal pole with a cone-shaped net on the end and takes it down to the water.
I'm looking for the insects under the rocks. I'm pushing the rocks and all the frozen ice around to get them out of their habitat where they're living.
Yeah. What do you think? Is it kind of fun?
Yeah. I'm excited to see if I got anything.
A few bugs lurk at the bottom of her net. Josephine says she plays in creeks in the summer, but has never tried fishing out insects before. She says she likes it, but isn't quite as enthusiastic about the program as her mom, Jennifer.
I love it. It's different, and I think it would be great for Josephine. She's a very hands-on learner, but encouraging her to like the program as much as me is a different story.
Stone says her daughter wants to go to school with all of her friends and have a typical middle school experience, and the Stream Academy won't exactly be typical. Whitney Diatri is one of the school's founders. She says the school is based around the district's standard core curriculum for 6th to 8th graders, but
our difference is the way we approach the content, and so we're working in a lot of interdisciplinary and community projects and the big R of research within the name Stream for longevity.
Their students will be outside exploring the environment and working in groups that span all 3 grade levels. Diatri says they want the students to develop the social skills they'll need for collaborating with others throughout life and learn about different career options. Co-founder Adriana Brown says the school is also focused on building a sense of connection, not just to the natural environment, but also to the Anchorage community.
And a huge part of what makes Anchorage the amazing place that it is the diversity of the cultures. So to make that easier to happen, we wanted the building to be located on the east side, so because that's where the density of our diversity is in this city.
The school is renting space at the Wayland Baptist University campus, which can be reached by major bus lines. As a charter school, they won't provide transportation. They're also weighing the lottery system so that at least 30% of the students come from the nearby neighborhoods. Brown says they offer other enticements, too.
Also, you get to pet cockroaches from time to time.
Though the cockroaches may not like it. Stream Academy's board is in the process of hiring a principal who will then hire teachers. The school needs at least 75 students to open its doors in August. The Anchorage School District lottery closes on March 24th. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Bonnie Sue Hitchcock grew up in Alaska, but she says she could never have written her debut novel if she hadn't moved out of state. Her young adult book, published tomorrow, is called The Smell of Other People's Houses. Set in 1970s Alaska, the book tells the story of 4 teenagers who live very different lives in different parts of the state, but end up coming together in surprising ways. Hitchcock is a former Alaska Public Radio reporter who now lives in Colorado. She says the novel is semi-autobiographical, and all of the characters are based on people she knew or wanted to know.
Or I just really wanted them in a certain setting, like especially the part that takes place in Southeast Alaska on the ferry, these 3 brothers stow away on the ferry. And that, I just used to always think about that. Like, what if we stowed away on the ferry? Where would you sleep? And how would you eat? And I know that's a horrible thing to think. Don't ever do that, Lori. Stow away on the ferry. It's a felony, I think. Maybe not a felony. But so, you know, just, you know, living in Alaska for so long and having so many different experiences in so many different parts of the state, you know, all of it came together. Plus, they were short stories, so I think it was easier to do this in that format where they were a bunch of short stories, and then that changed to become this longer narrative.
Bonnie Sue, without giving away too much, the book includes at least one big moment of magical realism. Why did you decide to add that element in?
I think part of that story started out really just as a fishing story. And so that particular scene involves some orcas. And I remember I was living in Southeast Alaska and hearing people tell me about how whales were going into Chatham Bay and they were stealing black cod off the hooks. There was a bunch of hype about that. And I always thought that was really interesting, and it kind of stuck with me. And so then it just kind of snowballed and became a little bit more of magical realism.
Several of the main characters in your book are Native. As a non-Native writer, how did you make sure you were making the characters realistic?
Some of the stories really do take on my childhood and situations that I had. And one particular story is almost verbatim a conversation I had with an Athabascan girl in Birch Park who was living there, who she informed me that I was not Native. And it was really interesting because my mother always told me I was Native Alaskan, but she never really explained to me that I wasn't Alaska Native. And I think that that experience, you know, was always in my mind, how we identify ourselves and how other people identify us and how stereotypes happen. And, you know, and then for many years I was produced independent Native news with Nellie Moore. And that was a really great experience and helped me understand the different tribes and all of the nuance surrounding writing, you know, about Native. And then I did have friends who are Inupiaq and friends who are Athabascan who their stories have made it into my book, and they've given me permission to do that as well. So I definitely had a lot of help in that regard.
There's so much attention on Alaska right now, not all of it good if you consider their proliferation of reality TV shows. Bonnie Sue, even though this work of yours is fiction, do you hope readers will walk away with a more honest portrayal of life in Alaska?
I do hope that, Lori. You know, I think it's really interesting. Like, one of the reasons writing for teens really speaks to me is because when I was, you know, growing up in Alaska myself, it's so easy to romanticize this place and to, you know, and even working with editors in New York and London on this book, there were so many situations that I thought were just so normal that they thought were so completely, you know, crazy or outlandish, or it was like talking to people in a different, you know, using a different language at times. And I don't think I could have written this book if I hadn't left Alaska, because I wouldn't have understood how different other places are. And that really also kind of made me want to make sure that it was as realistic and as true to my experience growing up. I'm sure it's not going to be everyone's experience growing up in Alaska. It's just the experience that I had. Everyone has their story.
Bonnie Sue Hitchcock's debut novel is called The Smell of Other People's Houses. She is launching the book in Sitka tomorrow and will have other events later in the week in Juneau, Palmer, and Anchorage.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Full Circle, delivering organic produce and artisan groceries, including Alaskan products, across Alaska. Learn about year-round delivery options at fullcircle.com/APRN. If you're looking for a career that will put you to work immediately without any educational debt, think about the apprenticeship program and learn to become a construction craft laborer. The construction industry requires hard work, provides great pay, and a bright future while building Alaska. Application deadline for the apprenticeship program is March 31st. Call to begin your debt-free career track today, 907-345-3853. This message sponsored by Alaska Laborers Training School.
David Norris of Fairbanks won the nation's biggest cross-country ski race over the weekend. Norris bested an elite field in Saturday's 51-kilometer American Birkebeiner in Wisconsin. Norris battled several world-class marathon skiers from France to capture victory in the race, which finishes on snow-covered streets in Hayward, Wisconsin. The 25-year-old Norris skied for Lathrop High School and in college at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and Montana State University. He currently skis for the Alaska Pacific University Ski Center out of Anchorage and is having a breakout season, including his first national Super Tour wins last month in Lake Placid, New York. Mushers and fans gathered over the weekend to celebrate the completion of the 2016 Yukon Quest in Whitehorse. As KUAC's Molly Reddig reports, the event was highlighted by awards and stories from the trail.
A About a dozen Tlingit dancers paraded onto the stage in fur, feathers, and traditional clothing to congratulate Hugh Neff for winning the Yukon Quest. They thanked him for mentioning Alaska's native people when he came across the finish line first. Neff was impressed.
I'm a native at heart, and I'm a wolf at heart, so it was like a dream popping out of my heart that I got to see flowing around me.
The 48-year-old Toke Musher is a longtime Quest veteran. Throughout the race, he repeatedly acknowledged Alaska natives such as George Atla and John Baker for teaching him how to mush and for producing his line of dogs.
I really take pride and am honored to be riding dogs that are, you know, created by some of the greatest dog minds in the world. I'm just lucky enough that all I have to do is play with them and love them.
In a speech to the crowd, Neff said he runs the Quest every year to race against himself. This year's Yukon Quest contained the usual excitement of a 1,000-mile sled dog race. There were midnight chases, moose attacks, miles of bumpy jumble ice, broken sleds, and an epic storm.
Stories. We all have stories.
Third place finisher Alan Moore talked about an upgrade he had made to his sled that backfired. He wanted to add some extra stopping power to go down Eagle Summit, so he rigged up a system to lower chains onto his runners with a string. It was working fine until he encountered knee-deep overflow on a creek and had to sit down on the back of his sled.
When I did that, I didn't realize that I stuck my foot through this cord. And now something's got me hogtied, and I'm going through this water. And now I turn over in the water. And laying in the water with the sled over sideways, and my dog's turned around just looking at me. What are you doing?
Runner-up Brent Sass won 4 ounces of gold for being the first musher into Dawson. Sass, Neff, and Moore have chased each other for years. At one point, early in the race, they stopped at a trail cabin to rest around the same time.
Just sitting there, you know, staring at each other, going, okay, what's your next move going to be?
He said it was fun competing against friends.
It's amazing you can be in such a competitive sport, in such a competitive atmosphere, and be joking around with the guy that you're like, really want to beat.
Japanese musher Yuka Honda said she was happy with her 9th place finish. It carried a special significance.
Yeah, this time I was just thinking about my mom so much because she just passed away.
Her mother asked her to run the Quest again because it had been a dream of Honda's for so long.
I try for my mom this time, so kind of special this year.
On the Yukon Quest Trail in Whitehorse, I'm Molly Redig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early, Zachariah Hughes, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Quentin Chandler in Homer, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., and Molly Redig in Whitehorse. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Alaska Community Action on Toxics believes future generations have the right to clean water, clean air, and toxic-free food. Learn more by visiting akaction.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Community Action on Toxics.
The Elder Mentor Program brings the wisdom of Alaskan elders into the classrooms and the communities across the state. Elders age 55 and older share their compassion, social support, and cultural values with the next generation. Earn a small stipend while supporting the educational staff and children. Alaska's Elder Mentors serve through the National Senior Corps Program. Mentor information at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.